headlines this hour. The Afghan president says the remobilization of armed forces is a top priority as Taliban militants capture a key city near the capital, Kabul. The Yemeni army says it has shot down a U.S. spy drone in Ma'rib province. Also coming up, U.S. authorities issue a new terrorism threat advisory, warning of foreign and pandemic-related domestic violence in the country. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Afghanistan's President Ashraf Ghani says the remobilization of armed forces is the government's top priority as the Taliban push toward the capital, Kabul. Ghani said fast consultations are underway to find a political solution. He also pledged to fight the Taliban offensive and to prevent further destruction and fatalities. His comments came after the militants took over the provincial capital of Logar, Pulla Alam, which is just 70 kilometers away from the capital, Kabul. Kabul is the last stand for government forces. The group is now in control of 19 provincial capitals across the country. The U.S. and a host of European countries have deployed thousands of troops to help evacuate their diplomats and nationals from Afghanistan.
And I expect that by the end of the weekend, the bulk of the 3,000 that we talked about yesterday will be in place. Probably not all, but the bulk. What we want to be able to do is to get there fast and get there capable. And be able to provide as much capacity to the State Department as we can. And our intention is to be able to move thousands per day.
The Pentagon said its forces will be ready to airlift American nationals from Kabul if needed. The UK government also said that a military operation is launched to help evacuate British nationals, urging them to leave the country immediately. The Taliban are tightening their grip on Afghanistan as they push ahead with an offensive against government forces. As the U.S. and Britain evacuate their diplomats and citizens, many are pointing to the West's failure in the country.
Fierce clashes have been ongoing in recent weeks between Afghan government forces and the Taliban militant group. But the government troops haven't been able to keep the Taliban from making rapid advances across the country. In the past few weeks, the militant group has managed to capture half of the provincial capitals in Afghanistan, including the country's second-largest city, Kandahar. According to estimates, the group is now in control of nearly two-thirds of the country.
Nobody with 75,000 troops or 100,000 troops can take over a whole country with practically no resistance, and thousands and thousands and thousands of your so-called enemy just surrendering and saying, here, take the weapons, unless they have some kind of meaningful political support. So whatever has happened in Afghanistan over these years, we're not back at ground zero. There is a change in the political climate in the country.
U.S. intelligence officials are reportedly predicting that the Afghan capital, Kabul, will be isolated in a month and will be taken over in a matter of 90 days. In the meantime, the United States and Britain have urged their nationals to immediately leave Afghanistan, with Washington announcing it's temporarily deploying 3,000 U.S. troops to Kabul to help evacuate American citizens and diplomatic staff. The advances of the Taliban have led the Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, to replace the country's army chief.
The Yemeni army says it has shot down a U.S. spy drone in Ma'rib province. Spokesman for the Yemeni military, Yahya Suri, announced the American Scan Eagle drone was conducting an operation in Magdal area when it was brought down. He said the military has recorded footage of the downing of the unmanned aerial vehicle, which he said will be aired on Yemeni media soon. Ma'rib has been a flashpoint of fighting between the Yemeni army and Saudi-backed militants in recent months. The Yemeni military, backed by Ansarullah forces, has been engaged in fierce battles to regain control of Ma'rib, the last stronghold of Saudi-backed militants in Yemen. The UK has sent 40 of its special forces along with an electronic warfare unit to Al-Mahra province in East Yemen. Reports say that the deployment's aim is to find the perpetrators of an attack on an Israeli-managed ship last month, but there's speculations that Britain has ulterior motives. The correspondent in Yemen, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, has more.
illegal move on Yemen soil has taken place by the United Kingdom, as it has sent 40 soldiers of its special forces and an electronic warfare unit to Al-Marib province in eastern Yemen on the pretext of finding the perpetrators of an attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off the coast of Oman last month.
Such UK moves in Yemen are not new, whether in Al-Mahra or elsewhere. Britain has an agent in the region, the UAE. All of Britain's efforts in Yemen, through its Emirati proxy, are focused on advancing the interests of the Israeli regime. What's happening today is considered a betrayal to the country by former President Abdrabbu Mansour Hadi. He has kept mum in the face of the British-Israeli moves in violation of Yemen's sovereignty.
An observer believes Saudi Arabia is the party behind the recent attack on the ship and says the deployment of the UK forces is aimed at justifying the presence of Saudi Arabia in Al-Mahra, as the regime has failed to take control of the province that has the longest coastal strip on the Arabian Sea.
The deployment of British soldiers to Al-Mahra came in the wake of the attack carried out by Saudi Arabia against the Mercer Street oil tanker. Ansar Allah was accused of being behind the attack, but this accusation was later denied. The presence of the British forces was planned beforehand, since Saudi Arabia has failed to control the province of Al-Mahra, and many people there are against the presence of Saudi forces, and they cannot remain there for a long time, as there are capable military forces in the country.
The people of Al-Mahra have repeatedly voiced protest against the presence of Saudis on their land. However, the presence of foreign forces in Yemen is not limited to the UAE, Saudi Arabia, or the UK. A US plane carrying 300 American soldiers and officers, along with 12 Black Hawk helicopters, arrived in Aden in southern Yemen last month.
Yemenis say the recent UK move proves that colonial ambitions by foreign powers are rising rapidly amid fragile situation in the southern and eastern areas of Yemen. They have also made it clear that they will continue fighting until all of Yemen's land is liberated and foreign forces are pushed out of the country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Israel's admission to its failure in the recent war on the Gaza Strip verifies Tel Aviv's increasing inability in facing resistance groups. Earlier, we discussed the issue in our news review program. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Israel's increasing admissions to its failure in the recent war on the Gaza Strip verifies Tel Aviv's defeat. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassam said the remarks coming from Israeli officials show the growing inability of the Israeli army in facing Al-Qassam brigades and other resistance groups. He said Israeli officials have repeatedly admitted the army's failure in dragging hundreds of fighters into the tunnels of resistance groups to kill them. Qassam noted that this reveals Hamas's improvement in its intelligence performance and its ability in exposing the enemy's plans. Tel Aviv launched a bombing campaign against the Gaza Strip on May 10, while Palestinian resistance groups responded with Operation Al-Quds Sword and fired more than 4,000 rockets and missiles into the occupied territories. The two sides announced a ceasefire in May 21. Let's find out more from our correspondent Ashraf Shannon on this story. And for an analysis, Mohsen Saleh is an academic and lecturer who joins us from Beirut. Okay, Ashraf, tell us more about this and what the Palestinian resistance factions have said.
Yes, Kaveh, Hamas spokesperson Hazem Qassam said that the recent statements by Israeli military personnel regarding the Israeli war during the month of May shows the weakness of the Israeli army and the Tel Aviv regime in confronting Hamas fighters, mainly the Izzedine Qassam Brigades, Hamas's military wing, as well as the Al-Quds Brigades, the military wing of Islamic Jihad, and other Palestinian resistance factions. During that war, Israel launched hundreds of air attacks and tank attacks against the civilian population in Gaza, killing nearly 250 civilians, most of them children and women and elderly people, and also medical doctors, and destroyed thousands of buildings, and also attacked the infrastructure in the Gaza Strip, and continues and refuses to allow the entry of supplies to rebuild Gaza. During that war, Israeli military so-called tried to trick the Palestinian resistance by releasing leaking information that the Israeli military will be entering through the eastern part of the Gaza Strip, and even Al Jazeera correspondent announced that on air. And many thought that the Palestinian resistance fighters, hundreds, maybe thousands, will be heading through underground tunnels to that area. And Israel is the one who was tricked by the Palestinian resistance factions, because they launched hundreds of airstrikes against that area, hoping to kill thousands or hundreds of Hamas resistance fighters, but they failed.
Listen, Saul, there have been statements coming from Israel through a variety of politicians saying that the army is fatigued, that they're tired, also saying that they're not prepared for a war. How much have the resistance groups contributed to Israel being drawn down to such a state where it feels like it's not ready for a war?
Well, actually, the history of the region has changed since 2000, actually, when the Israelis were withdrawn without any agreements with the resistance in Lebanon, and after that in Palestine, Gaza Strips 2-8 and 2-12, 2-14, 2-21. And these victories of the resistance access after Syria and Iraq and all these France, I guess, they let the Israelis unveil, and they felt that they are really defeated with all these fronts in Syria, Lebanon, and Gaza. And now all their statements indicate that they are in need of 100,000 soldier in order to protect these three fronts from Gaza, Lebanon, and Syria. And after that, I guess the Israelis felt, especially after the Saif al-Quds, they felt that even these groups in Gaza, they could really achieve victories against them and without being able to put down the missiles and the rockets of the Palestinian groups. Now the Palestinians yesterday and before yesterday, they insisted and they assured their people that they could really confront the Israelis in any attack or any aggression against Gaza Strip, and they are ready to gradually increase, accelerate the situation, and they have the power and the force in order to retaliate against any Israeli aggression. And what you have been talking about, this conspiracy or this web against the resistance, they show that the intelligence services of the groups, of the intelligence resistance groups in Lebanon and in Palestine, they could really overcome all kinds of conspiracies and all kinds of webs against the resistance. So we are seeing a new scene in the region, that the resistance groups were enabled through these years, two decades, to be able to collect their powers and have a special room for all of them in order to collect their efforts against the Israelis. After especially the American defeat in Iraq and in Syria, and of course in Lebanon, that's why the Israelis and the Americans and their Arab allies, they are trying with the economic sabotage, economic sanction against these peoples in Syria and in Gaza, and of course Syria, with some laws, American laws, in order to prevent these people from living this situation of victory. Now we have a new era of the resistance. Now it's probably the peak of the confrontation between the American and the Israeli and Saudi access and the access of the resistance, which are accumulating victories against the Americans and the Israelis.
Okay, thank you for that. Moses Saleh, academic and lecturer, and thank you, Ashraf Shannon, our correspondent there from Gaza. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Welcome back. The Lebanese president has expressed hope that a consensus will be reached soon on the formation of a new government. Michel Aoun said that white smoke will appear soon regarding the matter. He blamed Lebanon's current difficulties on wrong financial policies. The country has been run by a caretaker administration led by Hassan Diab since last August. That is when a huge blast devastated Beirut's port, prompting Diab to step down. Last month, Najib Mikati was tasked with forming a new government, following former Premier Saad al-Hariri's failure to craft a cabinet. Lebanon is grappling with a deep financial crisis worsened by the ongoing political deadlock. A recent decision by the country's central bank to end fuel subsidies has sparked a new political row there. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has issued a new terrorism threat advisory. In its bulletin, the department has warned that the U.S. faces threats from domestic and foreign terrorists. The department says fresh COVID-19 restrictions to contain the spread of the Delta variant could spark violent attacks by extremists. According to the department, pandemic-related issues may provoke more violence this year. The department has also sounded the alarm about possible terrorist activities around the 20th anniversary of the September 11 attacks. It says that New York and Washington could be subject to what it calls targeted violence by U.S.-based individuals inspired from abroad. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Hussein's Mubahala, sacrificing his dearest ones to rise up on the path of God. August 30th, 2020. This is a short part of a Dars-e-Kharij-e Fiqh lecture delivered on the eve of Muharram on March 12th, 2002. Many people from among the respected elders, the narrators of hadith, prominent figures, respected people, wise men, caring and somewhat caring individuals, kept coming to Imam Hussein and saying, "Sir, in doing this, you are engaging in a useless action, hurting yourself and the household of the Prophet, and humiliating the people of truth." They were saying such things. From the beginning, when Imam Hussein was planning on leaving Makkah, and some people found out about this, these various ethical obstacles began to emerge in front of Imam Hussein. This continued up until the night before Ashura. It is very difficult to have patience in the face of such events. In the same speech that I mentioned, I said that Imam Khomeini, may God be pleased with him, waited in the same way, and his patience was similar.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum.
أنا لا تشان.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance. September 27th, 2017.
أنا لا تشان.
analat.
There were many who told Imam Khomeini, "Sir, we are losing these young people. They are being killed in this way. The country is being ruined." During the revolutionary movement, some were telling him that he was causing the best young people to get killed. Being patient in the face of these clumsy sympathies is a great task, a very great task. It requires much strength. He waited. Patience is not just in the face of physical pressures and sufferings. Look at these pressures that are brought in the form of prudence and caution, where some say, "Sir, you are acting imprudently." To be patient in the face of these and not give up the path that is clear, which leads to growth. This is the great and beautiful patience that Imam Hussein had. And then his companions are killed one by one in that horrible situation.
Africa Today.
Tunisia, which is touted as a success story of the 2010 Arab Spring or the Islamic Awakening movement, is facing a political crisis after President Kais Saied suspended parliament for at least a month. He also fired the prime minister amid protests over rising COVID-19 cases and a struggling economy.
The President of the Republic will take charge of the executive power with the help of the government, which will be headed by a new leader appointed by the President of the Republic.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to another edition of Africa Today, a program which gives you an incisive analysis on events taking place across Africa. In the first part of our program, we are focusing on the recent political events in Tunisia. And in the second segment of our program, we shall be talking about how the Israeli regime has infiltrated the African Union and obtained observer status. This move has been opposed by a strong bloc of African countries and masses across the continent. Now stay with us till the end of our show as we analyze these subjects.
Tunisia, political crisis. Tunisia's President Kais Saied announced exceptional measures on the 25th of July, initially for 30 days, but open to extension. Let's take a listen to the President announcing some of the decisions he has taken.
The first decision is to freeze all the powers of Parliament. The second decision is to lift the immunity of all members of Parliament. The third decision is that the President assumes the executive authority with the help of a Prime Minister appointed by the President of the Republic.
This announcement by the President plunged Tunisia into a political turmoil. His opponents accuse him of having staged a coup, but Saied has said his actions are justified under the Constitution, which allows the head of the state to take unspecified exceptional measures in the event of an imminent threat.
The head of Tunisia's biggest party, the Islamic Ennahda Party, Rashid Ghannouchi, who is also parliament speaker, has accused President Saïd of a coup when he declared he was seizing executive authority. Now, for more on the situation in Tunisia, we contacted Elijah Magnia, a journalist and political analyst. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, first, was the move by President Saïd expected, or in other words, was it a surprise?
Well, actually, it's not very surprising because of the state and the country that was developing since the summer 2020, the corruption, the mismanagement of the government in place, and also the consequences of the COVID when the Tunisian population, only 7% of the population has been vaccinated. So the president took advantage of the Tunisian constitution. He is someone who understands very well the law. And in according to the 2014 constitution, Article 80, it gives him, in the event of imminent danger threatening the nation's institution or the security or independence of the country, he has the right to call the state of emergency.
Now, Mr. Magnia there says that the Tunisian president acted according to the constitution. President Saïd, a constitutional lawyer, has also reiterated that he acted according to the constitution of Tunisia and rejected accusations that his action amounts to a coup.
I have taken responsibility. I am taking a historic responsibility. Those who claim this matter is related to a coup need to revise their lessons in the constitution.
Some Tunisians celebrated the president's controversial decision, while others condemned the move, saying it's a return to dictatorship. Let's take a look at the mixed reactions by protesters.
The decisions by President Kais Saïd are not correct, against the constitution and reality. They bring us back once again to 1954. To see parliament closed by tanks is disgraceful.
Now, crowds in Tunis and elsewhere in the country immediately celebrated the president's move, while some condemned the decision. Now, are such mixed reactions an indicator that the society is polarized?
We can't forget that Tunisia was the first country who started the Arab Spring. It's a country that's very much alive, with a population that's very much aware of what's happening in their country, and they immediately react to it. This is why people were happy, because they see in the president someone who wants to put the country back on track and to stop corruption and do something about it. And he already claimed that there are many people who stole a lot of money from the country, from the ministries, and this is why people liked it.
Tunisia's Ennahda party has called on President Saïd to engage in dialogue to avoid deepening the country's political crisis. Party leader Rashid Ghannouchi, who has led Ennahda for decades, stood for election for the first time in 2019, winning a parliament seat and becoming the speaker. He now says they are going to use peaceful means to pressurize the government.
We are going to try to use all peaceful means, dialogue, negotiations, street pressure, pressure from organizations, internal and external pressure, to bring back democracy.
Ennahda has called for political talks to resolve the current crisis. Is dialogue an option for the president?
The president is not closing the door of the dialogue. On the contrary, he is saying that he is listening to his people and he's listening to the political parties. But because Ennahda is in charge and has a lot of power in the government and in the parliament, therefore its responsibility is according to its size. And because the government has been misdealing with the situation in the country, therefore Ennahda is responsible and should be accountable for what is happening in Tunisia.
The announcement by President Saïd that he is assuming executive authority with the assistance of a new prime minister is seen by some as the biggest challenge yet to the democratic system Tunisia introduced following a 2011 revolution that ousted former Western-backed ruler Zine El Abidine Ben Ali.
Tunisia is seen as the only country that succeeded in carrying out a democratic transition among a group of Arab countries that witnessed popular revolutions that toppled their regimes, including Egypt and Libya. Now, is the decision by Said in the long-term interest of the revolutionary ideals of the Tunisian people?
Absolutely. When we see people celebrating in the street what President Said is doing, it means he has the support of the population, and he has the support of the army and the security forces. Otherwise, he couldn't stand a similar move, not even 24 hours. But because the population is supporting him, because the population feels that he might have a chance to do something or to introduce some changes in the country, this is why he has the backup of the population and the security forces and many people, including members of the parliament, who are standing with him. So this is why it is a move that needs to be looked upon as a positive move, and the president is not taking the situation in hand, abolishing the position of the prime minister or the parliament, but he's only suspending it until he sees clear of how to move forward in Tunisia.
The leader of Ennahda has accused the United Arab Emirates of supporting the political turmoil in Tunisia. In an interview with the Times newspaper, Ghannouchi noted that the UAE was determined to finish off the Arab Spring that has seen long-time rulers overthrown in several Arab countries.
Now, our last question. What's your take on the international reaction towards the events in Tunisia?
Well, something has to be said that President Said doesn't have a strong party behind him to support him. He is a man of law, and he has been elected as a president with the support of the crowd in the street and the population. We see the international community dealing with him very cautiously, not condemning what's happening in Tunisia because they want to see further. Nobody can stand against the fight of corruption, and this is why nobody can stand against President Said as long as he is moving in that direction. Tunisia has a very aware population that will react to any dictatorship or to corruption, and the population is giving President Said a chance to express himself and to do something about the mismanagement of the country and to fight corruption.
Our guest there says that President Said has the goodwill of most Tunisians in his recent drastic measures. Now, will he meet the high expectations of the population? We shall keep you posted on the events in this North African state. Now, let's take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the Israeli regime's desperate move to infiltrate the African Union. Don't go away.
Israel infiltrates the African Union.
The apartheid Israeli regime is at it again, using underhand tactics and corruption to spread its tentacles and cover up for its crimes. In its latest move, this desperate regime has infiltrated the African Union and obtained observer status using undiplomatic means. On the 22nd of July, the regime attained observer status at the AU after nearly 20 years of lobbying.
This is while pro-Palestine language is typically featured in statements delivered at the AU's annual summits. Palestine already has observer status at the African Union, and thus granting the Israeli regime observer status is seen by many African countries as contrary to the pro-Palestine ideals of this pan-African body. South Africa and Algeria are some of the major African powers that have come out openly to vehemently oppose the decision by the African Union Commission to admit the Israeli regime as an observer in this organization. In opposing the move, the South African government says it was appalled by the African Union Commission's decision to grant Israel observer status at the African bloc.
President Cyril Ramaphosa was visibly upset by the decision and says his country was not consulted. Let's take a listen.
With regards to the admission of Israel as an observer at the AU, we've expressed our deep concern about that because it's a decision that was taken by the chair of the commission and without consulting the member states. Certainly we were not consulted. We have views because we are concerned about what is happening in Palestine, the continued situation there in Palestine, in our view, militates against just warmly accepting Israel as an observer in Africa, particularly in view of the positions and the views that we have taken ourselves as a country against the state of Israel on this issue. So we are opposed to their admission. We are concerned about the decision that has been made. And as it is now, a number of countries on the continent are expressing their unhappiness and dissatisfaction.
Well, for more on the Israeli regime's move to infiltrate the African Union, we contacted Tshepo Magama, an activist and former member of the South African Parliament. He's also a senior board member and spokesperson of Africa for Palestine. Thank you for joining us.
No, thank you for having me.
Now, our first question, what's your take on this shocking decision to grant the Israeli regime observer status at the African Union?
It emerged that the African Union Commission Chair, Mr. Faki, took this decision on his own without consultation with the member states and without consultation with the Executive Council of the Ministers of Foreign Affairs of the African Union. And so as a result, you know, most Africans were shocked. Political parties on the continent were shocked. Governments of the African continent were shocked. And indeed, as you would have seen from the response of our own government, our government clearly expressed its displeasure. You know, in fact, its abhorrence and condemnation of that decision that was taken without consultation with the heads of state or the ministers of foreign affairs of the African continent.
Algeria has taken vigorous steps with several African countries to revoke Israel's observer status at the African Union. According to sources, so far, Algeria has teamed up with South Africa, Tunisia, Eritrea, Senegal, Tanzania, Niger, Comoros, Gabon, Nigeria, Zimbabwe, Liberia, Mali, and the Seychelles to protest against the decision. Algerian Foreign Minister Ramtane Lamamra says his country will not remain silent regarding a decision that was taken by the AU without prior consultations with the member states.
Mr. Magama, as you stated earlier, many countries were not consulted on the decision. Now, has the Israeli regime used the divide and rule tactic to infiltrate the African Union?
Of course. I mean, it's typical of settler colonialists. This is what they do. You know, hundreds of years ago, they did exactly the same on the African continent. The earlier European settlers, using the divide and rule tactic, you know, to turn the oppressed against each other. And, of course, to break up solidarity amongst the people of the global south. And so this is one such tactic of the Israeli regime. Now, I think it's important also to see this in the broader context of what we have seen in the so-called, you know, Abraham Accord that led to the co-optation of, you know, countries in the Middle East and in North Africa, notably your Morocco, you know, and others on the African continent in trying to get support behind the apartheid Zionist project, you know, in Palestine.
The Israeli regime previously held observer status at the Organization of African Unity, the OAU, but was long thwarted in its attempts to get it back after the OAU was disbanded in 2002 and replaced by the African Union, or the AU. Now, how has the Israeli regime been able to infiltrate the African Union decision-making organs to obtain the observer status after many futile attempts?
What they then were able to do this time around was to bypass the structures of the African Union and then, of course, get to co-opt its seems. And some are even claiming, bribing the chairperson of the African Union Commission. We don't know whether that's true, but those are some of the allegations that are being made by social movements on the African continent to explain why this sudden change of mind by the AU chair, especially because he knows this is a highly controversial issue. It is a matter that has been resolved on by both the Executive Council of Ministers of the African Union throughout these 20 years and the heads of state and government throughout these 20 years, and they have consistently resolved to reject Israel's observer status in the African Union.
Israel's desperate move to endear itself to Africa comes after the African Union chairperson condemned the usurper regime's bombardment of the Gaza Strip in May this year, as well as violent attacks on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Speaking to French TV, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa also said Gaza reminds him of the apartheid era in his own country.
Well, the situation in Gaza is most worrying. We as South Africans are most concerned because the images that we've been seeing of people being prevented to move around, of their homes being destroyed, of people being driven out of their homes before they are bombed, of the Israeli soldiers manhandling people, brings back very terrible memories of our own history under apartheid, when people were forcibly moved from their homes, which they'd occupied for generations, when their homes were destroyed. So this, for us, is very close to our own suffering under apartheid. And when we see those images, we can't but side with the Palestinians.
Now, will Israeli presence at the African Union have an impact on the continental body's support for the liberation of Palestine?
But we are concerned even beyond whether it will only impact the support for the Palestinian struggle. But we are concerned that already it is dividing the very unity, it is undermining the very unity of the African. Israel's colonial project has only succeeded in the face of division amongst its opponents.
Over the past decades, the people of Africa have turned out massively in peaceful rallies to condemn Israeli regime crimes in Palestine. As recently as May this year, rallies were held to condemn Israeli atrocities in Gaza.
Nelson Mandela's grandson, Mandla Mandela, joined one such rally in Cape Town.
Mostly I stand here as a father. My son today is turning 4 years old, Mandela Ikram Mandel. And to continuously witness children in Palestine being shot in the back, being put in prison, it really pains our hearts as fathers, as parents, and also as citizens in the Republic of South Africa that have witnessed such brutalities in our past. And we are here today as a family with my wife, my father-in-law, as well as my mother-in-law, to say that we will not rest until we see a free Palestine in our lifetime. And we will speak against the brutality that is meted out against innocent children and women in Palestine. And that is why we are here united as a family today to charge forward with what Madiba once said, that our freedom is incomplete until the Palestinians are free.
Now, what's the reaction of the African masses towards this brazen move by the Israeli regime to infiltrate the African Union through bribery?
And other formations across the continent are indeed mobilizing. There are petitions, you know, that are being drafted. There's a lot of online activity that is taking place, especially in the context, the limiting constraint, of course, being COVID-19. And so there is a sense of, there is palpable anger. The anger is palpable amongst our people, in society. And so our people will not let this fly.
Well, the masses and governments in Africa are clearly resolute in their rejection of Israeli regime's move to obtain observer status at the African Union through corruption and other unconventional means. Our time is up for today, but as always, it's been great having you. Let us know what you think about our show by dropping us a line through our social media handle. Goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar. Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar. Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program dedicated to the life and times of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul. And I'm your host on this program, Ijaz Hussain. And the expert I have to discuss this, as usual, on the life and times of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, is Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, good friend, academic scholar, and Islamic scholar as well. A very warm welcome to you, sir. Salam and hello.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, we are looking at the Imam's will.
Mm-hmm.
Give us the analysis, if you like, the thinking behind why is it so essential that we Muslims must be united.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Let's look at what he said in this quote. Unfortunately, in the hands of conniving enemies and ignorant friends, the Holy Quran, this divine book that is empowered to decide man's destiny, has found no place anywhere except in graveyards and at gatherings of the dead, for the dead, although technically also of the dead.
Of the dead, of course, yes.
The instrument that was to unite Muslims and all mankind, the instrument that was to unite all mankind. Listen, Imam is... You know, it's his last will. So he's being hardcore.
He's very hardcore.
He's not even...
And because when he says all mankind, of course the Quran is for all humanity, for all time.
Right.
Whether we are believers or not is immaterial.
Right. The instrument that was to unite the Muslims and all mankind and serve as the scripture for their lives and salvation has turned into an instrument of division and dispute among men, or it has left the arena entirely. We all witnessed that whoever spoke of Islamic rule or of politics, which is the major role of Islam and its Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, or of the Quran and the Islamic traditions, was regarded as one who had committed a grave sin. The term ahunde siyasi, political clergy, came to denote a profound obscurantist.
Right.
These circumstances still exist. In recent years, major satanic powers have, through their puppet regimes, undertaken to reprint and publish the Holy Quran, distorting sacred verses to serve their devilish ends. Such Qurans are published with attractive calligraphy and binding and are distributed everywhere with the aim of eventually removing the Holy Book from all scenes. We all remember the Quran that Muhammad Reza Khan Pahlavi had printed. He succeeded in deceiving some people, including a few Muslim akhunds or preachers who, unaware of the aims of Islam, praised him for it. We note that each year, King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, at that time it was King Fahd in Saudi Arabia, spends a good deal of wealth of the people in printing the Holy Quran and considerable publicity and propaganda material in support of the anti-Quranic ideas, propagating the baseless and superstitious cult of
Wahhabism.
Fahd abuses the Quran, urges negligent people and nations to side with the superpowers. He uses noble Islam and the Holy Book to destroy both. And let there be no doubt that, I'm saying this now, this is not a quote,
sure,
that it is exactly the same way today.
Exactly.
With Abdullah.
With Abdullah and Prince Bandar.
And whoever it is that's going to rule the Al Saud, because Al Saud look at Islam as an instrument to maintain their
family own
rule.
Power.
They don't really care about Islam.
No, they don't, because they burn the Qurans as well.
Right. We are proud, this is Imam, and I love this part, we are proud, and our dedicated nation is proud that we adhere to the faith in which the Holy Quran speaks of the unity.
The unity, yes.
The unity of all Muslims and the oneness of mankind.
Oneness of mankind.
Because it's not just about
no.
unity of Muslims,
no.
it's the oneness of mankind.
Mankind, yes.
We are proud that our faith has retrieved the Quran from the cemeteries and has saved this holy book as man's prescription for freedom from all physical, mental, and intellectual bonds that push him deeper into slavery and nothingness.
Into non-existence.
We are proud to be followers of a religion whose founder has been designated by divine commandment, and in which Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salam, this servant of God, free of all bonds and shackles of servitude and serfdom, has been appointed to deliver mankind from all the chains of slavery and enslavement. We are honored that the book Nahjul Balagha, which is next to the Quran, is man's great manuscript for salvation, moral and material existence, and the greatest instrument for just rule and government, and has our infallible Imam Ali as its author. Well, you know, what can I say? We see these things. There's other things he says here, which I think is very nice. And I'm reading this in the beginning, and then we're going to talk a little bit more, because I think, you know, his own words really
say it all.
Right. Mm. Our nation, indeed all Islamic nations, as well as the meek and oppressed, are pleased to see that their enemies, who are the enemies of Almighty God, of Islam and of the Holy Quran, are indeed savages,
well,
who do not desist from committing any criminal acts to promote their mean purposes, and who are unable to tell a friend from a foe in achieving treacherous goals. I think this would...
Yeah, goes down, reflects
Syria
very well.
With
yeah.
what's going on in Syria.
Syria, yeah, very well.
Okay, now...
Savages.
Let's listen to this sentence that's going to come.
And digest that.
And this, let's just ponder on it.
Ponder on it.
The USA is the foremost enemy of Islam.
Ah.
Period.
What's new?
It is a terrorist state by nature.
Ah, and they declared a war on terror, didn't they?
It is a terrorist state by nature that has set fire to everything, everywhere, and its allies. The internet and its allies. Everything, everywhere, and its allies.
Allies as well.
No, no. And its ally, International Zionism, does not stop short to achieve its base and greedy desires.
Yes.
Crimes that the tongue and the pen are ashamed to utter and write.
True.
The insane idea of a greater Israel urges them to commit any shameful act. The Islamic nations and the mustazafin, the weak and oppressed, peoples of the world, are pleased to have Hussein of Jordan, a professional itinerant criminal, Hassan of Morocco, and Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, fellows of Israel, as their enemies. The people are proud to have them as their enemies. These are criminals with Israel. These are co-criminals with Israel, and commit any act of treason against their own nations to serve the USA. We cheer to have Saddam the Afalaki as an enemy, whom friend and foe know to be a criminal, a violator of human rights and international laws, and whose betrayal of the people of Iraq and of the Persian Gulf Emirates has been no less than his betrayal of our country and people. We and the oppressed peoples of the world are delighted to be objects of criminal accusations by the superpowers through their international mass media under their control.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
I mean, think about this, this is
right at the beginning. Well, you know,
I mean, think about all these people who, these Muslims who so desperately try to,
yeah,
oh, please love us.
Yes,
oh, please, we're good.
We are good. We are nice.
Right.
We're peaceful.
He's saying we're proud.
Yeah.
We're delighted.
Yeah.
To be objects.
Objects.
Of criminal accusations.
Exactly. Because it keeps us on the right path.
Well, I mean, I think it just, you have to understand Islam.
Yes. This is it.
Right.
This is what we're talking about.
What can be better, a better source of pride, this is him speaking.
Yeah.
What can be a better source of pride than the fact that the USA, with all its military might, its boastfulness, its claims, its mass media, and its allies among puppet regimes, has been so dumbfounded and disgraced in its dealings with the dauntless Iranian nation and the land of His Holiness Bari Atullah,
yeah,
that it does not know which way to turn and who to turn to. This is not the work of anyone.
This is not the work of anyone
or anything except divine assistance.
Divine
that
assistance.
Has awakened nations. Islamic awakening?
Yeah, Islamic awakening.
Particularly the Iranian Muslim nation, and has guided it from darkness into light, the light of Islam. And this is the final paragraph that I'm going to read. I now take this opportunity to advise the oppressed and noble nations, including our own, to stay firmly on this divine straight path that leads neither to the atheistic, mulhid, God-denying East, nor to the oppressive, idolatrous West, but to the path which Almighty God has decreed for us.
Exactly.
I further advise not to be negligent even for a single moment in being grateful for this blessing. Let no polluted hand of a superpower or its agents, whether domestic or foreign, affect your determination and will. Know that the angrier the Eastern or Western satanic powers get, the more proof it is for your divine support. And God shall reward and punish the deserving ones in the best fashion, in this and in the other worlds.
Oh,
and then he's
gone.
He quotes an ayah from Surah Mu'mineen, verse 88. Truly he is the Lord of all blessing, and in his hand lies dominion over all things.
Well, that, in a nutshell, says everything about the greatness of the Imam in terms of the fact of the understanding of Islam, because this has been a big, big problem for many centuries, and he's given us the path, if you like, the road to salvation, and telling us that in the circumstances we are now, and we are talking about 25 years on since he said those words, and we see the situation for what it is, and everything about it still is fresh. It's still it's become crystal clear now. I mean, at that time when he was seeing those things, that wasn't clear. But now we see them, the savages for what they are, who is the real enemy of Islam. And for us, as he says, the greatest divine blessing for us is the fact that the more angrier they become with us, the better.
And, you know, I don't know. I think it really, you got to think about what he's saying. He's saying that, you know, you have to understand the nature of who they are.
Exactly.
We were
talking about that,
right,
in another program, that we must know our enemy.
Right. And he's talking about their terrorist state by nature.
Yeah, of course.
So,
where are these human rights and all these other things they
then
talk about?
Then he's talking about the fact that, you know, we are delighted and it's a source of pride that they accuse us
of criminal.
And they call us names.
They call us
this
names.
This shows that
Islamophobia in Europe and whatever else you call it.
And he says the angrier that they get, and he's talking both Eastern and Western satanic powers, as he puts it.
Sure.
The more proof it is for your divine support.
Yes.
And this is something, you know, this is a higher.
This is Quranic, you know, this
right.
is the Quranic
and
thinking.
And so this is the point we're trying to make with the listeners, and of course, first, in the first instance, with ourselves.
Yes.
You know, don't don't look at the minimum level of Islam.
Look at the
maximum level.
Look at the maximum, look at the ultimate.
Look at that hardcore level of it.
Hardcore.
I don't know. Well, you can do it.
Yes.
You know.
It's not difficult because